This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, we'll look at how Colorado's recreational marijuana market has grown in the past 5 years and where it's going.
They're going to go out and try and stake a little claim of this little green rush we're seeing.
Plus, while most gun deaths in the United States are suicides, many Americans don't know that. We'll explore the findings from a new poll.
I do think it's stigma to some degree. It's denial.
That's coming up.
It's Wednesday, October 2nd. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your daily look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. The emerald ash borer has been confirmed in another Front Range community, this time in Larimer County. Local foresters say they found the highly destructive beetle inside an ash tree log just outside of Berthoud.
KUNC's Matt Bloom has been reporting on the beetle, and he joins us now. Matt, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Glad to be here.
Today we got the news that the emerald ash borer has made its way into a new county. What do we know about that?
We don't know whether this was a natural spread, whether it flew into Larimer County, or whether a human accidentally carried it into Larimer County. We don't know that yet. We know foresters are now doing field inspections to figure out how bad the infestation is. Josh Embry is with the town's Parks and Recreation Department.
It was only a matter of time, and now that it is here, we can consider that it's in town limits and residents need to act now.
What does this mean for homeowners, or I guess really tree owners in Larimer County?
Embry says that folks should be looking to see if they even have ash trees in their yards. If they do, they could be having a really expensive problem on their hands coming up in the very near future. He says they should consider removing or treating them because more than a fifth of the trees in Berthoud alone are ash species, which is the type of tree that the emerald ash borer infests. And once it does, it can't be saved.
And remind us, where else in the state? Where are we seeing the ash borer?
So it's already well established in Boulder County. The first time that we saw it detected officially was in Boulder in 2013. And ever since then, it's been creeping north towards Larimer County and southeast towards Denver. Just in the past year, we've seen two communities, Broomfield and Westminster, detect it within their jurisdictions.
Do we know why it's spreading so fast?
Yeah, there are a couple reasons. There are just tons and tons of ash trees in Colorado. There are around 1.5 million of them in Denver alone. So it's easy for the bug to just fly between trees and travel that way. People are also carrying firewood between communities, and that helps the beetle spread a farther distance in a shorter amount of time.
So what is the state doing to stop these things?
There has been this big state and federal effort to quarantine the spread of the emerald ash borer outside of Boulder County, but obviously that hasn't stopped it. So that's going to be repealed in December. So what's happening is the responsibility of managing this is largely falling on local governments and private property owners at this point. And according to my reporting, that's costing some neighborhoods multiple thousands of dollars to manage their trees and ultimately try and stop this pest.
Matt Bloom is a reporter for KUNC. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
A coalition of environmental groups is suing the federal government over the operation of a dam on the Colorado River. The groups contend that the Bureau of Reclamation's 20-year operational plan for Glen Canyon Dam in northern Arizona ran afoul of federal environmental laws. They wanted the agency to look at all the available options in managing it, including its decommission. The groups say climate change will further reduce the river's flows, and that will endanger the ability of reservoirs to meet the needs of the 40 million people who rely on the Colorado River. The lawsuit was filed in an Arizona federal court this week. If the environmental groups are successful, the Bureau of Reclamation could be forced to craft a new long-term plan.
Denver Public Schools now has more funding to focus on closing persistent achievement gaps. The DPS Foundation recently received a $10 million award from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The five-year grant will allow the district to strengthen individualized supports for Black, Latinx, and low-income learners. The college enrollment rates for Black and Latinx students who graduated in 2018 were 15 and 21 percentage points lower than their white peers.
An elk with netting tangled in its antlers has concerned Estes Park residents calling up local wildlife officials. Jason Clay with Colorado Parks and Wildlife says they won't intervene because the animal can still eat and get around. He says sedating it right now would be risky.
It could put it at a disadvantage because we are in breeding season right now. So a lot of bull elk, they fight over breeding rights.
To prevent similar cases, he says residents should take down volleyball and soccer nets in their yards.
Today, mass shootings and homicides dominate the national conversation on guns, but most gun deaths in this country are suicides. That's according to a new national poll from our reporting partners, Guns in America. For KUNC, Heath Druzin has more. And a note for listeners, this story talks about suicide.
I'm on one of the well-manicured lawns of Ann Morrison Park in Boise, Idaho. This state has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. Like much of the country, though, people here misunderstand what's causing the majority of gun deaths. What do you think the biggest cause of gun deaths in the U.S. is?
I would say homicide.
My guess would be accidents.
Mass shootings.
When it comes to firearm fatalities, Americans think of murder. According to a new poll from APM Research Lab, Call to Mind, and Guns in America, 58% think some form of homicide is responsible for the most gun deaths. Fully one quarter attributed the most gun deaths to mass shootings. That's all wrong, though. And experts say that makes it hard to find enough support and funding for suicide prevention.
I think that this misperception that most firearm fatalities or homicides are mass shootings, you know, it really drives where we put our policy emphasis. It really drives where we put our resources. And it really drives the conversation around gun control policy in the United States.
That's Jennifer Stuber, a professor of social work at University of Washington and co-founder of Forefront Suicide Prevention. Stuber has a very personal interest in suicide prevention. She started Forefront after her husband used a gun to take his life. Like many Americans, she didn't understand the scope of the suicide crisis until being touched by it.
Until it becomes, you know, just part of everyday conversations, that we're not going to see, you know, the statistics that you're reporting in this study turn around.
Horrific as they are, mass shootings represent a tiny fraction of gun deaths in America, but they get a lot of coverage. And even though the U.S. murder rate is well above other developed nations, homicides are still a distant second. To be clear, suicides represent 60% of all gun deaths. Despite that, less than a quarter of Americans can correctly identify suicide as being responsible for the most gun deaths, according to our poll. That misinformation can trickle down to local prevention efforts. John Roycer is showing me around the quiet offices of the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline, where he's the director. He says many Americans instinctively avoid the topic of suicide. Already this year, another Idaho suicide prevention organization shuttered due to lack of donations.
There is a mass shooting or a firearm death that's not suicide. A lot of those will hit the media, but unless it's a celebrity completion by suicide with a firearm, it probably is not going to be in the media.
Roycer said there's a tricky balancing act between reporting on suicide in a sensitive way and shying away from it completely. Still, he said we need to do better at having a public, frank conversation about the issue.
I do think it's stigma to some degree. It's denial, which is a defense mechanism that sometimes can be a good defense mechanism, but not around the issue of firearm suicides.
Another problem is a severe lack of research on the topic, driven in part by legislation in the 1990s that all but ended federal funding for gun studies. Dr. Mark Rosenberg worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention for two decades. He saw research into gun suicides and just about every other aspect of gun violence grind to a halt.
We don't really know what works most effectively to prevent suicide. We don't know what works to prevent school shootings or gun homicides or mass shootings, but we can find out.
Rosenberg says it's frustrating that we're failing to tackle what he sees as a preventable problem.
What's really criminal is not to be looking, is not to be trying to find out what works. That's what's really crazy.
Experts hope that changes soon. For Guns in America, I'm Heath Drusen.
Guns in America is a public media reporting project on the role of guns in American life. You can find more at KUNC.org.
And if you or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, you can call Colorado Crisis Services at 1-844-493-TALK. That's 844-493-8255.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about another facet of this polling, which found that a strong majority of respondents support enacting laws requiring gun owners to store their firearms with a lock, although few gun owners do.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
It's been over 5 years since the legalized marijuana market launched in Colorado, and today we're going to bring you a series of reports on what this has meant for the industry in our state.
Here to start us off with a look at where the market is and where it's going is Ken Amundsen, the managing editor for Biz West. Ken, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, 5 years after legalization, where do things stand for the marijuana industry?
There's been substantial growth in that industry from various sectors. It has kind of changed how Americans and Coloradans in particular perceive that industry. Just the acceptance is overwhelming.
So let's talk a little bit about sales and usage. What do we know as far as numbers go?
Of course, it's a very regulated industry, so everybody has to have a license to operate. And there are 41,000 people have applied to work in the industry. You have to be licensed to work in the industry.
That's a large sector.
Very much so. There are 3,000 business licenses in Colorado. And that would include dispensaries and grow operations and processing plants and all that sort of thing. And that particular part seems to be growing at about 14% a year, and they're projecting that it'll grow about 14% a year for the next 6 years.
What products are selling the most?
Cannabis that can be smoked is still the most popular, probably, but the edibles are gaining on that, and gummy bears are the most popular edible.
Remind us again of, in terms of tax revenue, how much the state has gotten from this industry and where that tax revenue is going.
$1 billion has been raised since 2014, and $266 million annually is what the state tax revenue is. It looks like a big number, but that's really a drop in the bucket when it's compared to the state budget. State budget is $32 billion. But to, you know, line that out, there are three different areas where the state derives tax revenue. One would be a 15% excise tax, and most of that money, in fact, all of that money goes to schools, most of it to capital construction, and then some of it to operations for schools. And then there's a 15% special sales tax on retail marijuana. This does not apply to the medical marijuana, just recreational retail marijuana. And 90% of that goes to the state government, 10% goes to local governments. And of the state's 90% share, about 12% of that goes to schools, 15% goes into the general fund, and 71% goes into the so-called marijuana tax cash fund. And then, of course, the standard sales tax, 2.9%, that's also charged. And all of that money goes into the marijuana tax cash fund. And that's used for health care, used for substance abuse, health education.
Okay. Awareness, you know, campaigns.
Yeah, those sorts of things, yeah.
And what are the projections going forward for the industry?
Well, as I mentioned, I think there's anticipated a 14% growth in sales of marijuana over the next 6 years, 14% each year for the next 6 years. That projection does not anticipate the addition of other states legalizing marijuana, nor does it anticipate any change in what happens after the 2020 elections. If there's a change at the federal level that would, you know, make things less difficult for businesses, perhaps that would grow even more.
Ken Amundsen is the managing editor of Biz West. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And even though the legal marijuana market in the state has been operating for 5 years, that doesn't mean that the illegal market has gone away.
KUNC's Esther Honig has been reporting on the marijuana black market in the state and joins us now. Esther, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Despite marijuana being legal, there is still a black market. Can you explain why?
So there's still a black market, and in the most simplest terms, it's there because marijuana is still illegal federally. So there are many states where it is still heavily restricted, and there is a market there for illegal marijuana. So I can grow marijuana in Colorado. I can ship it or, you know, get someone to transport it for me across several states. And then it's going to sell for 3 to 4 times the value that it would in Colorado. There's just so much money to be made that it's an easy, you know, opportunity for any entrepreneur, so to speak, who's willing to take that risk.
What do we know about how big the black market really is?
Well, what's really interesting about any sort of illegal industry, honestly, is that you're really only going to know how big it is depending on the resources that you can dedicate to tracking it down. I spoke to George Brockler. He's the district attorney with the 18th Judicial District. So that's in Denver. He gets most of these cases in his district. So they track down a lot of illegal marijuana operators in their area. They have more cases than any other district, but he admits it's also because they have more funding to go after it compared to a rural county. And this is what he said.
We have a thriving black market here in the 18th Judicial District, but not just here. My guess is all over the state.
And so I've talked to folks in other parts of the state, more rural areas where law enforcement is limited. And, you know, they might see it happening. It may take them months to be able to collect the information so that they can get a warrant to search the house to take down that operation. It's a lot of manpower. It's a lot of resources. Not a lot of them have.
How do people in this legal market here in the state feel about those operating illegally? Surely that's seen as competition.
Yeah, it's absolutely competition. I spoke to Scott Brady. He manages Smokies 420, and that's a marijuana grow and dispensary in Weld County. He sees the illegal operations. He called it a black eye on their industry because these folks operate with no oversight. We don't know what they're using to grow the plants, whether it's a toxic pesticide, and that has been a problem in the past. You know, they don't care about their customers' health or satisfaction. And so he feels that really his operation kind of gets lumped in with the illegal operations and sort of the public perspective on marijuana. And this is what he told me.
Each time somebody in the black market sells a gram, they're taking it right out of my people's pockets at the end of the day.
I'm wondering what it might mean for the illegal market here in Colorado if we were to see marijuana become legalized federally.
I think it means one of two things. Well, first, within our legal market, we've already seen a little bit of slowdown in terms of growth. And that has a lot to do with other states becoming legalized and their markets are taking off and people are no longer having to, say, travel to Colorado to take part in that weed tourism. But when it comes to the black market, everyone I've spoken to from George Brockler, who's, again, the district attorney, to black market marijuana dealers and growers, they're all in agreement, even Scott Brady, that the solution is federal legalization. If you legalize this federally, you take away the market, you take away that economic incentive to ship this stuff across the country to Mississippi and sell it for 3 to 4 times the price. And well, you won't necessarily eradicate it entirely. You'll replace the majority of it. You'll really do away with how robust and efficient the market is operating currently.
Esther Honig is a reporter for KUNC. Esther, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
But even though marijuana is legal in our state, as Esther reminded us, it's still illegal federally, a fact that poses issues for parts of the market.
Now, here to tell us more is Dan Mica, a reporter for Biz West. Dan, welcome back to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start by talking about new legislation that passed in the House of Representatives last week, and that's the Safe Banking Act. What is this and why is it needed?
Yeah, so the Safe Banking Act has two different major provisions. The first one would allow companies that deal in marijuana, whether they're grow houses, whether they're dispensaries, to be able to deposit and use the same kind of checking and banking accounts that normal businesses can do. At the moment, most dispensaries and most grow houses have to either deal in all cash, which means sometimes having to carry out their sales taxes and depositing that in cash. I know that some dispensaries use a cryptocurrency wallet to be able to take credit card transactions. And there are some specialty banks that will take marijuana business accounts but charge very high service fees and whatnot, because the main issue that they are worried about is that the federal government will look at them taking money from a substance that's federally legal and bringing it into the federal banking system. The feds kind of view that as money laundering, so to speak. So this bill would allow banks to kind of deal with marijuana companies without fear of reprisal. And the second part of that is that it would also create a safe harbor for businesses that work with marijuana companies. So this can be anything from allowing landlords to be able to rent buildings and office space to dispensaries or grow houses, to electricians and contractors to do just basic repairs. Right now, they kind of face the same problem.
This bill passed only in the House. What is next for it?
Right. So it passed with a fair amount of bipartisan support in the House. All but one House Democrat voted in favor of it, and about 47% of House Republicans voted in favor of it. So not a majority, but shows that there's, you know, at least a bit of a turning tide in the House. Now it goes over to the Senate, where it'll be co-sponsored by partially by Cory Gardner of Colorado. I see it having a bit of a tougher time getting through the Senate, as right now they're still working towards other big issues like trade. They might have to deal with the ongoing presidential impeachment inquiry at some point. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, even though last year he spearheaded the efforts to legalize hemp, he has shown really no support at all for legalizing marijuana. So even though we have a growing number of states nationwide, starting with Colorado, but including a lot of big populated states like Washington State, like California, like Illinois, really starting to take on medical and recreational marijuana, there still may be some resistance to it when it gets into the Senate.
What would this mean for marijuana businesses in Colorado and I guess in other states where it's legal too, if this passes?
So it would add another layer of credibility, so to speak. It would treat marijuana businesses like it would liquor stores to a certain extent. They would be able to have greater access to the financial system, which means it would allow more people to start a dispensary or start a grow house or start another marijuana-related business without having so much cash up front. So I think if it does pass and it does get to President Trump's desk and he signs into law, we're going to see a lot more small and independent dispensaries come out, a lot more people who don't have the private backing to go out. They're going to go out and try and stake a little claim of this little green rush we're seeing.
Dan Micah is a reporter for Biz West. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Winter is coming, and with the snow and cold weather comes enforcement of a new winter driving law here in Colorado.
That's right. In May of this year, the Colorado legislature passed a new law that requires vehicles meet certain traction control standards for winter driving. That'll be in effect from September 1st all the way to May 31st. Here to tell us what you need to know about this law is Andrew Hogel. He's a public information officer for the Colorado Department of Transportation. Welcome to Colorado Edition.
Howdy.
Tell us about the new law. What do drivers in Colorado need to know about what equipment they'll need to have?
Well, what we're talking about is a tweak to the already existing traction law for passenger vehicles that's used to be the old Code 15. The state legislature has tried to clarify this because it was a little confusing for, I think, most drivers. In an attempt to clarify this, what they've changed is that the tread requirement for vehicles that are headed up to the mountains needs to be better than it's been. It had been 2/16 of an inch tire tread for dry or for wet conditions. It's still 2/16 for dry conditions, but now under winter conditions, the traction law requires 3/16 of an inch on your tires. So you've got to have better tires, first of all, and that's going to go for all vehicles. Also, there's, as we know, all it takes is one car to spin out on the I-70 corridor and cause a backup for hours for hundreds, if not thousands, of people. So the legislature specifically called out the section of I-70 from Dotsero to Morrison as requiring drivers of certain vehicles to be prepared for the traction law during the months you just mentioned. I want to clarify that CDOT can call out the traction law as needed under winter conditions on any highway. So it's not just this highway that we're talking about, but they wanted to place special emphasis on this stretch. It's an effort to help with safety and winter driving across the state, but in particular along the I-70 corridor.
How is the state planning on enforcing a law like this?
Colorado Department of Transportation, CDOT, isn't the law enforcement agency in this. It's going to be the State Patrol. So CSP is going to be handling law enforcement of the new traction law. What they've made clear to us is that in this first year where the law has been changed, they are not going to be treating this as a primary law for enforcement, which means they're not going to have checkpoints. They're not going to be pulling people over looking for violations for the traction law. They are going to be enforcing it secondarily. So if you are in the mountains, get pulled over for some other reason, speeding or reckless driving or taillight or whatever, and they notice that you're not in compliance with the traction law, the citation will be for $130. If you are responsible for causing delay, if you are involved in a crash because you weren't compliant with the traction law, that jumps to $650. So they are taking it seriously, but I think they're also appreciating that this is a new tweak to the traction law. Folks aren't necessarily going to be able to go out and get new snow tires or have chains ready in these first few months.
Andrew Hogel is a public information officer for the Colorado Department of Transportation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, let us bring you a fascinating story about how lettuce changed the San Luis Valley. I'm Aaron O'Toole.
I'm Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.